Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. Thanks so much for being here with us. You're kind of here with us. We're on retreat today, but we've got a brand new wonderful conversation with Trent Horn, and we're gonna take some of his patron questions in the second hour. In the first hour, Trent gave a wonderful talk at the Catholic Answers Conference this year. Well, he gives a wonderful talk every year, but he's a big superstar there. Everybody loves him, and he does a great job. But this time, he went a little risky. He risked our ire by telling us four kinds of bad Christians because some of us could identify ourselves in these four types of bad Christians. Trent Horn is an apologist here at Catholic Answers, author of all kinds of wonderful books, including the single most popular book ever published by Catholic Answers Press, Why We're Catholic. And, of course, Council of Trent is what people know him for, where he is both irenic and persuasive. And I looked up those vocabulary words in order to say something about Trent today. Hello, Trent Horn. Thanks for being here.
I am astounded by your verbosity, Si.
Oh, muchas gracias.
And your magnanimous introduction.
Oh, well, don't be lugubrious. Oh, I don't even actually know what that one means. Sorry, I maybe messed that up.
I always thought that had something to do with peanuts. Like, don't be legumious, like a legume.
It does, yes. Legume, it does have that, a little bit of
it. It sounds like a gooey peanut treat.
And that's what it feels like to be lugubrious. As well.
You're a gooey melted peanut.
Yeah. Why did you want to talk to us about four kinds of bad Christians? What got into you?
So for the conference, I was on the plane flying to San Diego, and I typed into ChatGPT, "Hi ChatGPT, I really need to wow them at this year's conference," and I sort of put things off what would be a good topic, and it just spat this right out for me. Really? Unbelievable.
So ChatGPT is writing your content now, huh?
No, but I think I wouldn't be surprised if there's people who are writing content that sounds a little Trent Hornish because ChatGPT reads my things. I see people, by the way, who make parodies and stuff related to me. And it always is a little bit uncanny valley, especially when they take video clips of me and get me to say things I never said. It's amusing and terrifying at the same time.
I don't know if that's happened
to you yet.
No, it has not. I'm not a big media star, but I really don't like it because I don't look forward to that day where I will see myself saying something. I don't know. I see myself saying dumb things all the time. I don't mind if they do that, but if I see myself saying something that's contrary to the faith or that's going to bug me. That's really
good. Fortunately, Si, at least at this stage, when they make stuff like that, it just looks like somebody wearing a Si Kellett suit is saying that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So it's more scary than heretical or threatening. But no, I had been thinking in my head, I got this idea. I was thinking about Wayne Brittenden had a political compass that he created back in like 2001. And you see it all the time where people sort of like, where do you fall on the political compass, your political views? And there's different kinds. You have far left. You have like a spectrum, like far left, far right. But the political compass has two axes. So for the political compass, you have one vertical axis, which is, do you think government should be authoritarian? Like, hey, the government's telling everybody what to do. Or should government be more kind of libertarian? It's kind of more hands off. And then do you think government should implement liberal economic policies, like more of a welfare state, generous entitlement programs? Or do you think it should have more conservative, hands off kinds of economic policies? So when you have that, you can slot people into different things and see where they kind of fit amongst each other. But it's easy to pick the extremes on something like that. So if you are far left economic and authoritarian, that's Soviet communism. If you are far left libertarian, you're basically like a socialist, like an anarchist type person, like a far left anarchist. If you are far right economics and very libertarian, well, you're just the really, really crazy libertarians at the annual convention, the ones that people are like, why is he wearing a boot on his head running for president of the United States of America? But all right, whatever it may be. Then finally, if you're far right economically and very authoritarian, a lot of people like to put the Nazi party there, but actually they're the National Socialists. They're more at the top of the graph in the middle because they're still closer to collectivism and socialism. I picked over there, you're basically would be like kind of like a monarchy that's very pro-capitalist, or maybe like societies run by a dystopian corporation, basically.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah.
Talk at the conference, I referenced Omnicorp, which I hope our listeners will know what I'm referring to.
Is that a Detroit company, Omnicorp? Are they based
Your move, creep.
Yeah, okay.
Dead or alive, you're coming with me. One of Peter Weller's finest roles, RoboCop. If you RoboCop is too Gen X reference for you, WALL-E would be, by and large, WALL-E would be maybe another example of a society run by a dystopian corporation. The point is, you can easily find the extremes there. So I thought, okay, what if you could do that to the Christian life? And I picked two values. So the vertical axis would be conforming to society. At the top is somebody who they just want everybody in society to like them. They conform to everything that's acceptable in modern society, highly conformative. The bottom of the axis, so imagine it's like a grid in front of you. The bottom of the axis would be anti-conformity. If majority of people like it, you don't like it. If majority of people say, yeah, that probably happened in history, your first instinct is that's probably a conspiracy theory. If a lot of people like it, you're suspicious of it. So conformity and anti-conformity. And then the horizontal axis is morality.
Oh.
And so on the right end of the spectrum would be moral rigor. You're highly, highly morally rigorous, which can be a bad thing. We'll get into that. Some people think, well, what's wrong with that? Well, it can be a bad thing. Rigorism is an error like laxity. And then left is morally lax, like you really let a lot of stuff go, even things that Christians and non-Christians agree on. But you're not as concerned about upholding all the moral doctrines. So you put that out in a framework, and then you get the four corners. So you would have, and we can break them down later. But the corners would be, you know, morally lax and conforms to society, morally rigorous and conforms to society, morally lax and is very anti-conformity, and morally lax and is morally rigorous and very anti-conformity.
Oh.
And those were a lot. And so I didn't include like the bad Christians, like, you know, heresy. So obviously heresy is a bad thing. We can do a whole show just on that. I found these values were very helpful in sorting out like, oh yeah, when I think of someone who embarrasses me and identifies as a Christian, they usually fall into one of these extreme zones.
But they can all be Christians in the sense of all confessing Jesus, but they just,
yes,
like they're not like Christians who are like just a syncretist or something like that. You're staying away from all that. You're talking about these are people that could reasonably all be called Christians, but they are going at it four completely different ways.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So they find a kind of abuse or an error. And so it sends them off on a wrong path, even though there's truth in various elements.
Yeah.
That's why you always want to try to get to the center of my grid, have a perfect balance between rigor and laxity and conformity and anti-conformity. But that's like balancing on a pin, on a very sharp cone. It's very easy to fall off the cone and roll down into one of these corners.
Yeah. So this is, in a certain way, it's kind of like a double Aristotelian take or Aquinas take, that the you're looking for the golden mean here. You're looking for the thing between the two extremes.
Yeah, and so we've got four extremes.
Yeah,
so
it's, you've doubled
double,
it up.
Double means. Aristotle would say, you know, golden mean, double golden mean, and then if you lose that, physical challenge. To be a virtuous person, you have to survive the physical challenge or you get slimed.
Where does feats of strength come in? Is that part of physical challenges?
it would depend. A lot of times it's just climbing up a very slippery hill. But Double Dare, another older millennial Gen X reference for everybody.
But there is a thing about somehow we roll towards extremes naturally. Or I don't know if that's a consequence of the fall or something, but virtue is very rarely at the extreme. Virtue is usually like, kindness, for example. You can be just, you have no kindness in you and you're a jerk. On the other end, you could have an excess of kindness where you're kind of a weirdo who makes everybody uncomfortable. Every virtue, it needs to be properly balanced. It needs to find that center point.
Yeah. And I think what happens a lot with the virtues, I mean, Martin Luther King Jr. was asked about this. He's like, people asked him, are you an extremist? And he said, well, there's nothing wrong necessarily being an extremist. Like, there's nothing wrong being an extremist for love. Like, you were extremely dedicated towards loving other people. But I think a lot of times with these virtues, when they become extremes, the meaning of the virtue is basically lost. Like, someone who is extremely, extremely kind, because they allow people to suffer so much, they're not even really kind anymore. We would just call them sentimental. They very much appeal to people's sentiments and don't want people to feel bad, but they have lost the essence of what kindness is. So a lot of these things, like even you, I'm going to be 100% temperate. You know, I'm going to be extremely temperate. I'm going to fully deny myself. Eventually, it's not even temperance anymore. It can be turned into like a disorder kind of asceticism or an imbalanced, unhealthy life. I find when it becomes extreme, it's just the virtue in name only.
All right, Trent Horn is our guest. We're going to talk about four kinds of bad Christians. He gave you the basic grid layout, but now I assume he's going to name names. I assume he's going to put people on this chart. And is that correct? Are you going to?
I did an episode last month.
You did?
I discussed this.
Oh,
and I did name names, Catholic and Protestant. So I'm not. And actually, I had a lot of comments in the 30% of my channel audience are Protestant Christians and Orthodox mixed in there, and they were very happy with this framework and found it to be very helpful. And so I could say, yeah, here's where I could find, I'm not going to gang up. I can see this or that in here and try to just be fair, but I call them like I see them.
All right. So the four types of bad Christians, one of the things you can do on this is you can find out as Trent talks about them, where do I fit on this? Where do I fit on this grid? And am I in a healthy place or in an unhealthy place? And it's always good to ask ourselves those kind of questions, and things that help us to answer those kind of questions are really valuable. So we'll get into that with Trent right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at magnificat.com.
The EWTN home video highlight for October is They Might Be Saints, Father Michael McGivney. Miracle hunter Michael O'Neill follows the trail of Father Michael McGivney, founder of the Knights of Columbus and America's first parish priest to be beatified. This documentary explores the miraculous cure that led to Father McGivney's beatification. Order your DVD at EWTNRC.com or call 1-800-854-6316.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kelly, your host, our guest, Trent Horn, this hour. And he's got a grid system. Trent Horn has developed a grid system for finding out if you're a good Christian or a bad Christian, or at least helping to find out whether you're a good Christian or a bad Christian.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Trent.
And I also want to make clear what I said in my episode is we are all tempted towards these extremes. None of us is perfect. James 3:2 says we all stumble, make many, many small mistakes. So I'm not putting this out there as like, oh, I'm the perfect one and here's all the bad people. I put it out there as in, you know, I see where I can fall into these different tendencies and try to be guarded to avoid that. We all should be able to do that.
Yeah, because I thought maybe when you started this, one of the four kinds of bad Christians was going to be podcaster, but you didn't have that on there.
Oh, what's funny is that's you can find them in all four quadrants.
Okay, all right.
All four quadrants. All so right. I'm sure there's a podcaster in them.
All right, so if you're thinking of a grid, a two-dimensional grid, a square, so to speak, and we're trying to place people on this square, one axis is conformity. How much do you like to conform? And the other axis is more morality. Do I have these correct?
Yeah, I like – it helps me put it in my head. The vertical is conform and anti-conform, and the morality is the right side is morally rigorous and the left side is morally lax.
Okay. All right. So let's get into this. Maybe give us some names and
call people. We'll start with the first one. So that would be the upper left quadrant. That would be you are highly conforming to society and you also tend to be morally lax. And that would be your classic cafeteria Christian.
Yeah.
Like, think about the kind of person that they're Christian. They like saying they're Christian, and they like sharing with people aspects of the Christian faith that are pleasant and most people agree with, like, love thy neighbor, care for the poor, feed the hungry, stand up for the downtrodden, even love your enemy. So the things that are very praiseworthy in Christianity that the majority of people respect and like, they're happy to share that.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, they might not necessarily be super on fire about it, but it's cafeteria style, right? They pick what they want. But the other aspects of Christianity that society is not as keen towards, talking about the necessity of, you know, carrying your cross, dying to yourself, believing that Jesus Christ is the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through him, aspects of things related especially to sexual morality. A lot of times they'll either ignore these, or they'll ignore them, or that they might not even know. They might not even know. I have seen, I remember watching an exchange with Congressman Eric Swalwell and Ben Shapiro. And he was critiquing Shapiro, for Project 2025, trying to paint him as this crazy conservative. And he's trying to paint him as like this wacky person. And he's like, so, you know, do you think homosexuality is a sin? And Shapiro's like, well, what do you mean by homosexuality? But are you asking me as an Orthodox Jew, what do I think about the Old Testament says about homosexuality? Well, yeah. And he talks about the conduct, not just the orientation. But you'll hear that. I saw Don Lemon do something similar with Candace Owens, that you'll have people who will, especially in Hollywood or in media, will embrace Christianity. And they'll be baffled at the idea. How could anyone ever come to these ideas? And
that are in the
very
Bible.
Very clearly, they haven't read it. They have right. not read it. They're just totally ignorant of it. And they just think of them, their own nice intuitions. That couldn't possibly be. That could only be something out of the imagination of a raving lunatic fundamentalist. And then they actually haven't grappled with it. I find that's very common with people. C.S. Lewis dealt with this as well when he said certain beliefs are not Christian. And he said, look, in my time, you know, he said, for a lot of people, the word Christian just means a nice chap. And he's saying that's not what that word means.
Right, right. As a matter of fact, there was a time when if anyone was rude or had any kind of just impolite behavior, you would say that was unchristian behavior. Well, that's unchristian behavior. It kind of got equated with politeness and that kind of thing.
When that was a norm, which will be funny when we come back to our fourth type of Christian here at the end.
All right, so the cafeteria Christian, I'm going to check off which ones I've been in my life, and I have been this one. So I'm going to see if I've covered all four quadrants as I've gone through my journey here on the earth. But I've certainly been the cafeteria Christian, conformed to the world and morally lax. Yes. Okay. So let's go to another of the four types of bad Christian.
The next one would be someone who really conforms to what the world wants, but also claims to be morally rigorous. And some people said they didn't see a difference between this one and the cafeteria Christian when I shared it online, but I think I can elucidate it. So it's someone who tries to say, I believe everything the Bible says, and I am trying to be a holy, pious Christian. But I can live out this pious, morally rigorous faith in a way that does not offend the larger segment of society.
Oh, okay.
That doesn't offend everybody. And I would say that those are the progressive Christians.
Oh, really?
So these would be people who try to square the circle by saying, well, the Bible doesn't really condemn homosexual conduct. It only condemns pederasty, man-boy relationships. So you can be a Christian and still support so-called same-sex marriage. You have this on the Protestant and the Catholic side. You have dissenting Catholic theologians who will say this. On the Protestant side, there's a young man, Matthew Vines. He has a viral video on this, and he wrote a book in 2014 called God and the Gay Christian. There's many other Catholics, theologians, quote-unquote, who try to push this as well. I've critiqued on my show a Catholic theologian, Emily Reimer Berry, who says, you could be a good Catholic and support abortion as a kind of self-care. It's just like the gymnastics they will do to try to say, oh, the things that our world loves and the Bible condemns, well, the Bible doesn't really condemn them. The other thing that they will do in being morally rigorous is they will take certain popular progressive political causes and say that Christians must support those.
Yes.
And that's the difficulty, where they'll have a kernel of truth. Like, they'll say, you know, Christians have a duty to care for the environment. Well, yeah, they do. We're stewards of creation. We shouldn't just destroy the environment for no good reason. To which they'll say, okay, then that means a Christian must support my particular program to combat climate change that is going to, you know, shut down every nuclear power plant, make everybody walk around wearing a solar powered suit. And, you can only have red meat once a year or something like that. I don't know. And then Christians, if you're a good Christian, you have to do this, or other things like that. They'll say you have to support this, when you might say, well, we can agree on the basic thing. But when it comes to the application of the principles, you know, Christians might disagree on those things. So I find with these progressive Christians, they're very interesting. When a Christian wants to, let's say, outlaw legalized abortion, they'll say, oh, you're just a culture warrior. You don't really care about sharing the gospel. You just want to create controversy and you want to be a culture warrior. But those same progressives will say, we need to call our congressmen and pass an assault weapons ban to protect people. And suddenly, when they want to change the law to protect people, they're not culture warriors. They're just being good Christians. That's where I find it. For me, it's like, look, either both are good Christians or both are culture warriors. But don't try to act in a way where the only acceptable Christian political causes are the ones that the secular left also happens to like.
Okay, so the progressive, that person is a conformist to the world, in the sense that they're perfectly comfortable with the values, but they're morally rigorous. And I do recognize that this habit of importing into Christianity moral demands that are not fundamentally Christian, that, for example, I think one actually, and I'd like to get your take on this, but I think immigration is a very difficult one right now, because I do think there is an absolute biblical mandate to love the immigrant, to care for the dispossessed, to be like, this is not a Christian option. This is not some kind of, God said, this would be nice to do. Like, he's really harsh about this, that we must care for the immigrant. But then that becomes moral demands that are actually foreign to Christianity. That the border needs to be.
I'll give you an example. So in my book, Confusion in the Kingdom, I address this, and I've addressed some progressive Catholics who, misreading older magisterial doctrine, not even that much older, but misreading Veritatis Splendor or Gaudium et Spes, will claim that deportation is intrinsically evil, that it can never be done. And they'll say you can never deport anyone for any reason, even if they are a violent criminal, for example.
Right.
You can't. And they'll cite, When Gaudium et Spes talks about different intrinsic evils and it mentions deportation, but it's very clear, and I cover this in the book, I look at all the times deportation is mentioned in magisterial documents, and only twice is it related to the immigration controversy. The vast majority of cases, the intrinsic evil of deportation refers to totalitarian regimes that would murder people by just collectively sending them to an inhospitable place where they're going to die, like Siberia, for example, you don't have to kill people in camps, you just round them up. This happened in Russia. They sent people essentially to an island in a swamp where you can't survive, and basically almost everybody died. So, you know, that's what is being discussed here. Rather than, when you go back, you see, like, Pope Francis was asked even by a Colombian reporter, what do you think about deportation? He says, you know, it's on a case-by-case basis when you have to figure that out. You go to the Vatican. If you illegally immigrate to the Vatican, to Vatican City, you will face a massive fine and be deported and kicked out of the city for at least 4 years.
Right.
It could be longer, even like 20 years. So that's where it's like, okay. And this will get us to the other quadrants when we come back, that there's a mirror image of this on the issue of immigration. But here, they'll take, we should love the foreigner. And I would say also, like, Catholic political teaching is social teaching. I'm going to be radically honest. I'm more of a conservative politically. But Catholic social teaching, when you take it all together, I would say is a tiny bit left of center. I'm going to be just frankly honest about that.
Yeah, I think so.
So there's things I – well, I don't know if you –
I think that's right. I think that that's basically right, but it's not. But it's a tiny bit. It's not extreme, and it doesn't and it doesn't impose on people that you have to embrace. For example, I don't think that the Catholic moral teaching says anything about whether you have a wall or don't have a wall between two countries. I don't think it says anything about that. So I can go to Mass with you and be perfectly comfortable whichever one of those things you want. I don't that doesn't matter. What does bother me is when people impose it and say a Christian cannot believe this on things that are clearly you can believe them.
You can believe, And our next group that we'll talk about takes the other end of the spectrum in trying to impose things, but maybe on a different political end.
All right, well, we'll come back. We've got the cafeteria Christian and the progressive Christian. I'm trying to figure out, have I ever been that progressive Christian? I'm going to think about that during the break. We'll be right back with the four kinds of bad Christians. Nobody's getting off the hook. Back with Trent Horn after this.
Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
Lots of people have big questions about Catholicism. It needs a big book of answers, and now it's got one. The Big Book of Catholic Answers is filled with helpful replies to more than 250 questions about the faith. Questions about God, salvation history, the Creed, the Bible, the list goes on and on. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
What was the church like in its infancy? In a word, Catholic, and Joe Heschmeyer seats. In his best-selling book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, he gives you the details from the historical records of the first two centuries of Christianity. Right now, get a copy for just $10, plus free shipping if you live in the continental United States. Get more information and order The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at theearlychurchwascatholic.com.
What is the Catholic Church? Everyone seems to have an opinion, but the Church never quite fits into the boxes people make for it. In The Faith Unboxed, author Andrew Petiprin looks at some of the most common boxes people put the Catholic Church in and explains why they don't fit. In doing so, he brings us closer to what the Church really is, the institution founded by Christ. Order The Faith Unboxed today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Here we are in the midst of Advent, and Trent Horn decided to get everybody's blood pressure up for Advent, make every single Christian mad, because we each fall, we're going to fall somewhere on this grid that he has made of conformity. Are we conformists or nonconformists? That's one axis of the grid. And are we morally rigorous or morally lax as Christians? That's another axis of the grid. And either of these axes, we can have an excess of. We can be excessively conformist. We can be have a deficit of moral of conformity. We can be excessively rigorous. We can be excessively morally lax. And so, where do we fit? Where do you fit? Well, he's done two groups: the cafeteria Catholics, who he says are. Who conform to the world, are very conformist, but are kind of morally lax. Then the progressive Christian, who's also conformist with the world, likes the values of the world, but it's kind of morally rigorous and wants to boss you around about what you have to do and what you have to believe as a Christian, and having to do with progressive causes, or kind of the worldly causes. Maybe I could I would describe it this way, and I'll see what Trent Horn has to say about this. But you can kind of almost go, what does the world believe? By go, what's the agenda of the United Nations? If you really are morally adamant that we all have to follow the agenda of the United Nations or the European Union, You are a moral rigorist in a certain way, but you're also conforming to the world's idea. What do you think of my what do you think of my proxies there?
No, I think that's correct. That a lot of times you'll see, okay, where are you going to take the lead? And people will look towards figureheads in the liberal or progressive political movements and try to align with what is popular there versus what the church teaches, what scripture teaches in guiding us, where in a lot of cases the church will give latitude on how we can implement the good. I mean, I try very hard. I can't stand it when there are Catholics who will say to Protestants, oh, you have all this chaos and we have authority in the church, so you need to submit to Rome, who will then turn around and nitpick every single thing Pope Francis said or Pope Leo said. I try very hard when I read the encyclicals to say, okay, well, what am I being called to? What is doctrine? What's a prudential judgment? And not just hand wave away the judgment, so give them serious thought. My biggest thing with Pope Francis on maybe Fratelli Tutti and some of the other issues on economics were simply that I wanted to follow his advice on economics. I just couldn't make heads or tails of what was being recommended, because it's that kind of NGO sort of speak that was just very difficult sometimes for me to parse out. But otherwise, yeah, we want to make sure that we're taking our leadership cues from those God has entrusted to be our leaders and our shepherds.
All right, so we've done the conformity axis. Conformists, the hardcore conformists, people who do want to be conformed to the world, the morally lax and the morally rigorous, the cafeteria Christian and the progressive Christian. Let's get over to the nonconformist side of the ledger here.
Yes. So these are the people who say, hey, I'm a Christian, and if you don't like it, tough, man. That's how it goes. And
oh, that's me, man. That's me. That's how I feel.
And they understand. I mean, Jesus said in John 15:19, if you were of the world would love its own. But because you're not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Romans 12:2, Paul says, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind. But a few verses later, Paul also says, if possible, so far as it depends upon you, live peaceably with all. So we shouldn't just be rebelling.
I hate that part, Trent. I hate that part. That's the worst part.
And Paul says, look, when you're prophesying, when you're speaking in tongues, don't act like a bunch of maniacs.
Oh,
people will walk into the assembly. Yeah, if Paul were alive today, there's a lot of people online who would have said he was tone policing. You're tone policing.
Yeah, he is. That's right. That's what he's doing. He's tone policing. And it's good. Like, you know what? Police your tone a little bit. Like I joke about that. I hate that part because it's kind of fun to be the outrageous Christian who just is like a bull in a china shop. But
yes,
like police your tone. He said be peaceable, and he's an apostle of the Lord Jesus Christ. Maybe listen to what he had to say about being peaceable.
Exactly. So So I think that's important here. That the anti, just because if the world loves it, I hate it. That's bad, because God did give human beings rational minds and a conscience. So the world does get things wrong, but people can also get things right. Like, people can come across basic moral truths. And that's why they like, in Christianity, love thy neighbor, because they say, oh, loving people, that's a good thing. Like, it's not like a foreign thing. They're like, I never knew this before until you told me love was good.
Right.
Or that good is good. People can figure out a lot of these basic moral truths because of God put it on their conscience. But then when people just start really rebelling, they're anti-conformity, and there's two kinds here. So you have the classic example would be, so go back to the quadrants. This would be bottom right. They're very morally rigorous people. They want to uphold the Christian faith, but they also don't care what the world thinks. They just want to uphold the faith and do what they think is right. And these are the people that I would call fundamentalists, your classic fundamentalist. Now, I'm very clear. I've said before, it is not bad to passionately defend the fundamentals of our faith. That's not a bad thing. It's also not bad if you have theological views or you have different views that are contrarian or not accepted by the mainstream of the population. So, for example, take the age of the Earth. It's the scientific consensus. The Earth is several billion years old. The universe is, at least 10 billion years old. That's a general consensus. But there's people who believe in young earth creationism, that God made everything without evolutionary processes about less than 10,000 years ago. I'm not saying you're bad for believing that. That's pretty anti-conformity. the problem here is you're being overly rigorous when you say, oh, and to be a good Christian, you have to believe that.
Yeah.
When God did not require us to believe that. Or, I mean, I've seen people now, it is crazy, like there's going to be people who relish denying what's popular. Like they relish the fact that they say the moon landing never happened and that was faked. And they'll mock people who say, yeah, I think that happened. There's good evidence. And they'll mock people for that. Instead of just saying that's just their weird thing that they have, fine. I'm like, where are you coming from? Which also I think is a very silly thing to believe, because if there was one institution that had everything to gain and had the ability to prove the moon landing was faked, it was the Soviet Union. And they clearly would have done that if it was faked, because it would have been a massive propaganda win for them. But they didn't, because we're there, and there are reflector plates on the moon, the astronauts left there, by the way, that you can aim a laser at and it will come back to you. Sorry, that's just my gripe about the moon landing right there.
No, I like it. I'm one of those wacky people that believes in the moon landing. I believe in all kinds of crazy things. When we saw that television that they landed on the moon, yeah, they were on the moon. Like I'm wacky that way.
Yeah, but that's the thing, and it's not even just the moon, but especially you'll find this in rigorous areas. They'll take things that are permitted and make them obligatory. So to go back to an example in salvation history, take the issue of circumcision. So in Acts chapter 16. In Acts 15, they have to convene the Council of Jerusalem, because it tells us that some men were coming down to Jerusalem and were saying that you must be circumcised to be saved. And what's funny is we always think, like, I would have never been those people. But their arguments probably were hard for the apostles to deal with, because they would have said, hey, I'm just reading the Old Testament. It says this is an everlasting covenant. Do you know what everlasting means? I'm reading it. I'm just reading it right here. Oh, by the way, what did Jesus say about circumcision? And we don't have anything recorded in the Gospels of Jesus mentioning circumcision or that it's not necessary anymore. So there would have been a lot of debate from this, the people using fundamentalist tactics. And so Paul and the other apostles had to say, no, it's permitted, but not obligatory. So we know it's permitted because in Acts 16, Paul circumcises mm-hmm. Timothy, because Timothy's mother, his father was a Greek. And so he circumcises Timothy to make it just easier to evangelize to other Jews, just to make it easier for them to be able to do that. It wasn't sinful to do that. You could get circumcised. When Paul writes in Galatians chapter 5, he says, what matters isn't circumcision or uncircumcision. It's faith working through love. But he's saying, don't demand that other people have to do this. That's fundamentalism right there. And we see it with, you know, evolution. I've seen some people say that you cannot, a dating couple or an engaged couple cannot even hold hands prior to being married out of danger of like overly romantic feelings dwelling within the person, which is just not what the church teaches. But if something's an occasion of sin for you, don't do it. But that doesn't mean that you can blanket say, oh, well, that's sinful for everybody.
Yeah, that's this actually has bothered me sometimes in some corners of Catholic media of it seems like laying heavy burdens on people because you disapprove of something. You say the church disapproves of it. And this has come from everything from what books people can read to you know, what movies people can watch. And there are people who will say you are, you know, like I know people who are really good Christians who honestly, they haven't really thought through all the subtleties of the death penalty, for example, but they just accept that the church says it's not admissible now. You can't do it.
Right.
And then other people will go, they get mad at them like there's something wrong with them. No, they don't have to have thought. They can just kind of go along and what they can accept what the church teaches. And it's, you know, they're not obsessed about the thing you're obsessed about. That doesn't make them a bad Christian. Leave them alone. And I think that we do this fundamentalist thing is actually a pretty serious problem in online Christianity, in some of the media Christianity.
And what's amazing to me, Cy, from these people who will say, you've got to stand up to the Pope for teaching this, and they'll try to say they're based, they're trad, they're the traditional Catholics. Well, when I read what traditional Catholics actually said 100 years ago, you get something very different. So, for example, in 1906, Pope Pius X said this. He said, "The one duty of the multitude, i.e. the lay people, is to allow themselves to be led, and like a docile flock, to follow the pastors." So the people who, you know, are the namesake of Pope Pius X, who, you know, hail him as a hero, he would say, "Hey, wait a minute, why aren't you, what are you doing here?
Yeah,
you're supposed to be the
right.
docile flock." Now, exactly. It's important, it's good, though, for the magisterium to reflect and always be able to develop and understand and teach with greater clarity, because this kind of advice, while important, can lead to errors like clericalism. The idea that priests and bishops
can never, I mean,
there's, I know people who say, you know, that Padre Pio claimed that you should never speak ill of a priest, which means if a priest was involved in abuse, you can't tell people that because you can't speak ill of a priest. And it's mind-numbingly crazy to see. And even today, you still have people who will say that stuff, regardless of the painful lesson we have been learning for over 20 years in the church related to that.
Yeah. All right. So the fundamentalist nonconformist, this person is perfectly willing to not conform to the world, but is morally rigorous, has all kinds of moral demands. They will tell you what you should be wearing. So
it's interesting, Sai, while the progressive demands you do things that liberals enjoy that God doesn't require, the fundamentalist will demand you do things that more traditionalists like. That God also didn't require; He merely permitted.
All right, so I'm going to take a break, and I'm two for three. I've been in two of these three categories. I can't remember ever being a conformist to the world who was morally rigorous. I don't remember that, but I have gone through my fundamentalist stage, certainly, where I maybe was overly bitter at the world and overly morally rigorous. And when I say I went through that stage, it's not like it's over. All these things are still in me. I hate to say it, but I still got them in me. We'll find out the last of the four kinds of bad Christians when we come back with Trent Horn on Catholic Answers Live.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The EWTN on-demand platform features 50 new podcasts every week, as well as an ever-expanding library of audio and video content. For Catholics who want to learn more about their faith, simply using their mobile device, computer, or TV, your favorite EWTN programs are available 24/7. Visit EWTN.com and click On Demand. EWTN is the global Catholic network.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul? And that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I think probably the primary reason to know the four kinds of bad Christians that that Trent's talking about, and I do hope that will be the title of his next book, The Four Kinds of Bad Christians. I'd love to see this in print. The primary reason to know him, of course, is so that we can avoid falling into the pits. And I suppose, Trent, there is something about especially when we first come alive in the faith, or we first feel the excitement of the faith, it's actually ours. It's not something that our parents gave us or something. We tend towards excess in the beginning because you just kind of have a fire burning.
Yeah, that happens a lot, the zeal of converts, especially. So I find that cafeteria Christians tend to be more common among cradle Christians and cradle Catholics than among converts. If you think of your classic cafeteria Christian, it's somebody who grew up in this milieu. And so they, usually they grew up in themselves in a very doctrinally loose sort of environment, where they come from that regard. I find what's interesting there is, yeah, they'll grow up in that. But some people, maybe they'll be a more progressive or fundamentalist Christian. They might have, or even our next category we'll talk about here, might have grown up in the opposite end, and then they jump over. So the cafeteria Christian, however, I'll give an exception there. Many times people will grow up in a kind of fundamentalism, or they'll have fundamentalism, realize it's incoherent, and it makes the faith look silly, and they'll think that the only alternative is this kind of bland and offensive cafeteria Christianity, and so they'll run away to the other quadrant.
All right, so we've got the cafeteria Christian who is conformed to the world and morally lax. We've got the progressive Christian who conforms to the world and is morally rigorous. We've got the fundamentalist Christian who does not conform to the world and is morally rigorous. This person's at war with the world. What about the person who is a nonconformist and morally lax? Give me an example of that person.
This is probably the weirdest, not necessarily the weirdest, it's the most interesting one on the list, right? Because if you tend to, why would people be morally lax? They tend to be morally lax because they want to just take the easy path in life. You know, the moral laxity, live and let live.
Oh, yeah.
The cafeteria Christian loves to say, don't judge other people. So they'll say, you know, judge not. Okay, fine. They want to live and let live. But at the same time, so normally those people who tend to be morally lax, they tend to be very conforming with others. And their tendency is to more, when they want to be rigorous, it's towards things the world loves, like liberal political causes. There's an interesting group of people I've been seeing more and more of lately who will be morally lax, but then but in some areas. So they're actually morally rigorous in areas that are very anti-conformity. So that they will be very, very vocal in their opposition to abortion, to so-called same-sex marriage. But then they'll also have very morally lax views or morally atrocious views on things that Christians and non-Christians generally agree about. I divided this into two types, and I did an episode on this a month ago. One of them is actually a problem as old as time, and that would be the hypocritical Christian. So this is somebody who likes to say, you know, preaching about the sins of fornication, the sin of sodomy, you know, preaches against that, makes people upset and offends them. But then they lead a double life. They are fornicating. Oh, yeah. They're engaged in sodomy. They're having an adulterous affair. They preach about all these things. They're embezzling from the church. So what's interesting here is on the outside, they are anti-conformity, but on the inside, they're actually morally lax. And so they lead a double life. I think it's important though to remember, a lot of people will be down on themselves, like you do something wrong and you're like, oh, I'm a hypocrite. No, if you do something wrong, you stumble, you fall into sin, you choose sin, and you repent of it and you're contrite, that just means you're human. You have weaknesses. You're in the flesh. Sure. A hypocrite is not someone who says one thing and does another. We all are on a spectrum of say one thing, do another, because none of us is morally perfect yet. A hypocrite is someone who says one thing and believes another. That is a hypocrite. The word hypocrite comes from upokrites, under the mask. There's someone who will say sodomy is wrong, abortion is wrong, but they don't really believe that. They say it because they like getting attention from that, and they live a double life in a completely different way. That is a hypocrite. You say one thing, but you don't even believe what you're selling to people. It's just an act. And I think there's a lot of online grifters and rage baiters. They'll put out stuff that makes people upset. They don't even really believe it. They just say it because they know it makes people upset and it gets them attention. So that's one of the hypocrites. The others, I call them barbaric Christians. So these are ones, yeah, like I said before, they'll be like, you know, anti-sodomy, anti-abortion, anti-pornography. But then they will hold basically a lot of bad 19th century outdated immoral views, like saying that interracial marriage is disgusting or non-whites are morally inferior or that women are less human than men and women don't deserve to have the same basic rights that men have, or that Jews are responsible for all the bad things in the world. So it's that kind of stuff where they are very anti-conformity to the world, but then they'll also reject morals that even, you know, Christians and non-Christians at this point in history you know, if I was debating a liberal progressive, we would both agree that racism is wrong. We might disagree about what racism is, but the barbaric Christian will say, well, you know, what do you mean by racism? Maybe some races need to be lovingly ruled over by other superior races or stuff like that. It's wild. I'm seeing more and more of it, mostly with anonymous profiles online, but I worry that it's growing.
So I'm having a hard time. This is the hardest one for me to get a bead on. So this person is nonconformist to the world, but is actually putting a false face to the world. That would be
the hypocrite. Okay. So that would be the hypocrite. The barbarian is someone who's like, yeah, they will do things that makes the world mad by upholding controversial Christian doctrine.
Right.
Like
right.
I said, on life or sexual issues.
Yeah.
But then they will make the world mad by rebelling against really general moral truths that everybody, including Christians, agree, like the wrongness of racism, for example, or sexism. Another example would be this. To circle back to the beginning, Cy, you talked about how there was a time if you were rude, it's unchristian, like they're synonymous. I find with these Christians online, I call barbaric Christians, people they disagree with, they will speak in the most vile, insulting, abusive manner possible, and just think that that's perfectly fine for a Christian to do. And it's a kind of behavior I don't see fundamentalist Christians engage in, who are very anti-conformity, but they still uphold the Christian teaching that you ought to, you know, season your words with salt, Colossians 4:6, Colossians 3:8, let no filthy talk come from your mouth. It's really weird. The few kinds of things that they will rebel against is more just to, you know, help them be edgelords, be rage baiters, to fill this need to be provocative. They're provocative for provocative's sake sometimes, or to indulge in these anti-Christian attitudes.
All right, I may be wrong about this, but I feel like some of the hyper-masculine movement, the pro-masculinity movement, which often seems to me like just a new kind of victim class pretending that I'm not a victim. Like, say, men have been victimized, so I got to be this hyper-macho thing. And I don't agree with people who say we have a masculinity problem. We don't need more masculinity if that's just some abstract thing. You're going to get yourself in trouble. We need more men who are like Jesus. Like, there's a particular kind of masculinity. And it's if it's in imitation of Jesus, there's no one more masculine than Jesus. He's
absolutely
tough as nails. And
absolutely.
And formidable in every way, as you would want a good man to be, formidable in every way. But that's not just any old masculinity that you grab ain't going to do the job for you. You better grab onto a particular kind of masculinity that's in imitation of Christ.
Right. And so I think that's the problem that we're seeing now is, and I think that there is in a modern culture, treating masculinity as if it's just a bad thing, or that being men is a bad thing.
Right.
So with the barbaric Christians, there's an inversion. So you'll have among more liberals, they'll say, oh, men are the source of the world's problems. Masculinity is a bad thing. That's the problem. What these barbaric Christians will do for masculinity is they'll do the photo negative. They'll say women are the problems in the world today, and femininity is the bad thing.
Good Lord.
So we just need masculinity and manliness, and we need women to just shut up and stay at home. And when I will be honest, Cy, when I see the most masculine guys I know don't have a chip on their shoulder about women. The least masculine people I know are the people who always talk about masculinity. It's like a coping mechanism.
Yeah, it does seem almost like a compensation in a certain way. And the comfort, the genuine comfort that Jesus has in the presence of women and that women have in the presence of Jesus would suggest he doesn't have anything to do with it. I mean, you see Martha and Mary are his friends. Well, that's a pretty strong word in the ancient world to say someone is someone's friend.
Exactly.
So, Trent, if you want to wrap this up and put a bow on it in any way, we can do that when we come back. But we're also going to get to questions from your patrons, people who have supported the Council of Trent. We've got to talk about the Conference of Trent that's coming up April 11th?
11th.
April
11th. Conferenceoftrent.com.
Conferenceoftrent.com. Find out all about it. But we've got Trent for another hour. Don't worry. He's not going away. I didn't ask you which of these four categories you're most tempted to, but I might ask you that when you come. But which one? It might be barbaric. You might be a little bit of a barbarian. I don't know. We'll see.
Possibly.
All right, right back with more Trent Horn on Catholic Answers Live.